Hello there, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by Plan B Network and BitBox. This is the course on my first book, Sovereignty Through Mathematics, and this chapter is called An Immaculate Conception. I'm Knut Svanholm, and I'm here, as always, with Luke DeWolf. Hello there, Luke. How are you today?
Hello there, Knut. Yeah, I'm excellent. Looking forward to this one. And this Immaculate Conception, certainly going to be an interesting topic, all about emerging phenomena and other interesting tidbits. So I'm looking forward to getting into it.
If you want to know more about the Academy, go to geyser.fund/projects/infinity. And there you'll find all the options of how to support us and how to actively join the discussions and participate in this thing.
Great. Shall we dive in?
I think we should dive in. Over to you.
Okay. This is An Immaculate Conception. Some concepts in nature are harder for us humans to understand than others. How complex things can emerge out of simpler ones is one of those concepts. A termite colony, for instance, has a complex cooling system at its lower levels. No single termite knows how it works. Completely unaware of the end results, they build complex mounds and nests, shelter tubes to protect their paths, and networks of subterranean tunnels to connect their dirt cities. Everything seems organized and designed, but it is not. Evolution has equipped the termite with a pheromone receptor that tells the termite what task he ought to engage himself in by simply counting the number of neighboring termites doing the same thing. If there's a surplus of workers in an area, nearby termites become warriors, and so on. Complex structures emerge from simple rules. The fractal patterns found all around nature are another example. Fractals look complex, but in reality, they're not. They're basically algorithms. The same pattern repeated over and over again with a slightly modified starting point. The human brain is an excellent example of a complex thing that evolved out of simpler things, and we humans still have a hard time accepting that it wasn't designed. Religions, which themselves are emergent systems spawned out of human interaction, have come up with a plethora of explanations for how we came to be. All sorts of wild origin stories have been more widely accepted than the simple explanation that our complexities just emerged out of simpler things following a set of rules that nature itself provided our world with. Interesting start. Knut?
Yes, this is alluding to a lot of things here, like how evolution is very much akin to the free market process, like how things emerge out of simpler things, as I say in the paragraph. Like there's this famous example where Milton Friedman talks about how no person on earth can construct a simple pencil from scratch, because all of the pieces of the pencil, the graphite and the wood and the paint and the brass and the rubber are all from different continents, and no single entity planned for that thing to happen. It's just the free market and prices and price signals telling people what to do that allows this more complex thing to emerge from simpler things. So I think this is sort of building up to that, the free market is a evolutionary system.
Yeah, interesting one. And, you know, I think one thing here is, of course, the contrast you're immediately making, that religions are one of these things that want to put a top-down explanation, whereas bottom-up is really how these things have emerged. And there's a contrast here already between top-down systems of government that want to control every aspect of the economy, whereas if just left to everyone's own devices, they would form some kind of community, like a termite colony or something like that, that very likely would end up being more efficient. I say very likely at the start here, only because we haven't gone into the rest of the details explaining fully why that in fact is the case. But yeah, just drawing a parallel, and interesting that it's a parallel to that the financial atheism also is maybe going to have more contrasts with religious structures also.
Yeah, I say if there's any way in which I've changed my views on this stuff since I wrote this book is that humans playing God is worse than the humans believing in God. Like that's the key thing here. As soon as human beings, we're somewhat inherently arrogant and think that we can influence stuff to such a large extent, like the whole notion that we can fix the climate, for instance, is one such arrogance. And I think this is something, well, if anything, I think humanity should be a bit more humble in terms of like when analyzing itself. Like we often think that we have a bigger impact than we do. And following this thought is that if people were left to their own devices and free to do whatever they wanted and trade however they wanted, the results would probably be better.
Yeah, maybe let's explore some of the examples now from the chapter. Okay, off we go. Complex systems emerge out of human interactions all the time. The phone in your pocket is the result of a century of mostly free global market competition, and no single human could ever have come up with the entire thing. The device, together with its internet connection, is capable of a lot more than the sum of its individual parts. A pocket-sized gadget that can grant instant access to almost all of the world's literature, music, and film, which fits in your pocket, was an unthinkable science fiction a mere 20 years ago. Bitcoin, first described in Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper 10 years before these words were written, was designed to be decentralized. Still, it wasn't until years later that the network started to show actual proof of this. Sound money, or absolute digital scarcity, emerged out of the network not only because of its technical design. How Bitcoin's first 10 years actually unfolded played a huge part in how true decentralization could emerge. And this is also the main reason why the experiment cannot be replicated. Scarcity on the internet could only be invented once. Satoshi's disappearance was Bitcoin's first step towards true decentralization. No marketing whatsoever, and the randomness of who hopped onto the train first were the steps that followed. Bitcoin truly had an immaculate conception. Okay. Knut?
Yes, this is there's a lot here to unpack. I mean, the analogy I love to use is like if you take a shower and use a towel after you've showered, you get one result. But if you do them in reverse, so you use the towel first and then go take a shower afterwards, you get a completely different result. So the order in which things unfold in a system like this matters a lot. And that is also like, this is also trying to describe how Bitcoin is not first and foremost a technological innovation, but a sociological discovery, if you will. Like a way, what it enables is a way for humans to interact with one another that simply we didn't have that before Bitcoin. Like we didn't have absolutely sound money or absolutely finite money supply. Like that whole thing, it is much more a sociological or a intersubjective discovery than a technological innovation.
Yeah, and I think tying it to the example that you gave was useful here because basically, to start off with, the phone is another one of these things where, as you say, the full picture of what it's capable of wasn't necessarily ever understood when cell phones were first invented. The idea of something to phone other people eventually became you could send text messages to other people. And then suddenly, kind of overnight, bam, the internet also gets added to that. And then suddenly you have all of this extra capability on top. And Bitcoin, there's these famous examples of all the technologies that had to come before Bitcoin for it to work, basically, this massive technological stack, not the least of which was the internet, but plenty of other things had to come before that as well. Lots of communication technologies, we keep referencing Lynn actually in this series now, but she had a very good description of all of the things that needed to come into place. Like really, I like her description of how there was essentially a gap in communications. Communications could move a lot faster than money for a couple of hundred years. And then basically Bitcoin has bridged that gap. So that's an interesting one. We talked about that when she was on the Bitcoin Infinity show. But anyway, that example of that Bitcoin kind of needed all of these pieces to come together, and no one really could have known that Bitcoin was going to be the thing that would emerge. There were plenty of other attempts at some kind of magic internet money, Hashcash, eGold, other things like that. But Bitcoin was the one that seemed to hit exactly the properties to get it to take off. So it wasn't exactly the first internet currency, but it was the one that did the job and picked up the network effect. I think that's another point you're basically making here, right?
Yeah, I always say that it wasn't the first, it was the last. Like, that's a much more sound way of looking at it, because like the key difference is decentralization, which is a term that people throw around way too lightly, in my opinion. I think decentralization in Bitcoin is an unfortunate means to a much greater end, which is this money with a finite supply that cannot be double spent and cannot be, you know, corrupted. So it is somewhat unfortunate that we need that, because the system would have been so much more efficient if we didn't. But the only way to check that no one is double spending any coins is for every user to keep track of everything else every other user is doing at all times, which is what running a node is all about. Like, we keep each other in check, and that is why we need the decentralization. Back to the paragraph, like you mentioned Lynn, I'll echo that and mention a thing that Jeff Booth talks about a lot, is how the free market is the mechanism that made the iPhone from sand. Like, it's literally made out of grains of sand. So we, through this emergent process of the free market, human beings were able to construct this magic James Bond device out of sand, and it cannot be understated how powerful a force the free market of ideas is.
Totally agree. And I think another point here is also that this is the reason why none of these other so-called cryptocurrencies have anything going for them either, because they're all trying to mimic what Bitcoin already did naturally. In other words, it's the top down to Bitcoin's bottom up, something like that.
Yeah, they're misguided at best and scams at worst, usually the latter.
I'm sure we'll talk more about those at other times, but for now, let's move on.
Absolutely.
On to the next one. The network has shown a remarkable resistance to change over the last few years, especially. And its current state might be its last incarnation, given the size of the network and the 95% agreement threshold in its consensus rules. It might never change again. In that case, an entirely new complex life form will have emerged out of a simple set of rules. Even if small upgrades are implemented in the future, the 21 million coin supply cap is set in stone forever. Bitcoin is not for humans to have opinions about. It exists regardless of what anyone thinks about it, and it ought to be studied rather than discussed. We don't know what true scarcity and a truly global anonymous free market will do to our species yet, but we are about to find out. It is naive to think otherwise. Various futurists and doomsday prophets have been focused on the dangers of the impending general artificial intelligence singularity lately, warning us about the point of no return, whereupon an artificial intelligence will be able to improve itself faster than any human could. Such a scenario could, as news anchor Ron Burgundy would have put it, escalate quickly. This may or may not be of real concern to us, but meanwhile, right under our noses, another type of unstoppable digital life has emerged. and it is already changing the behavior and preferences of millions of people around the globe. This is probably bad news for big corporations and governments, but good news for the little guy looking for a little freedom. At least, that's what those of us who lean towards the ideas of the Austrian School of Economics believe. This time around, we will find out whether this is the case or not. No one knows what it will lead to, and what new truths will emerge out of this new reality. Interesting. What did you mean by that, Knut?
Yeah, I meant just what you said. the key point here, I think, is that Bitcoin is to be studied rather than something for people to have opinions about. Like this is such a fascinating system, because the fact that we all have to agree, like a supermajority has to agree that a change to the protocol is a good idea. What that means from another angle is that only good ideas can be implemented, because we define what good is by everyone agreeing. And yeah, to play the devil's advocate here a bit, sure, the 21 million supply could theoretically change in the future if everyone agrees that that is a good idea. However, the likelihood that that will happen is extremely low, since the whole point of this thing is that it cannot be copied. So like the statement that it's set in stone forever is true from that angle. So this is the Bitcoin being like the most robust system ever and the most fragile system ever at the same time. I find that so fascinating, because it is robust because we are robust. And we are robust because Bitcoin incentivizes us to not try to cheat the system, but try to follow the rules. So it's like positive sum game theory going on here. And it's just beautiful in my opinion.
Yeah, one of the major FUDs that I hear from people at times are, can't you just create your own Bitcoin? Like, why don't you just go make your own version of it? Why don't you go make Knut coin, right? And even if they don't mean go make your own crypto that's random and has got its own blockchain or whatever, even in the more reasonable cases where they mean, why can't you just clone Bitcoin, make your own and start using that? It's the way around the supply cap, right? That you can just make infinite Bitcoins by making another version. Well, what they don't understand is that no one's going to adopt it, right? An actual fork in Bitcoin.
You can make your own, and good luck. Have fun saying fork.
Exactly. I don't think we should signal boost any of the so-called forks of Bitcoin by name or anything, but let's just say none of them are doing all that well.
No, but it is crucial that this is open source and that anyone can change it is crucial for the thing to function, and that people actually get to choose from the people choosing what software to run is at the very base. That's the very foundation of why this works. And people will choose in general, people will choose the software that functions better. In other words, the one that functions as a medium of exchange, especially over time, better than the other, which is why all the other Bitcoin forks, since they are all doomed to just lose their purchasing power over time, because money is a winner takes all game, then it makes absolutely no sense for people to run that fork, unless they're actively trying to rug pull someone else and trying to run a scam. And I've been thinking maybe. Out of curiosity, a couple of months back, I started reading Roger Ver's book. This is a confession. I only read a chapter or two, but it was so funny because, like, I could debunk every single argument in every single paragraph in that book. And maybe I'll just do that one day. Then again, I don't want to give the guy and Bitcoin, these Bitcoin forks, any more attention than they already have, because all they do is cause confusion, in my opinion, and they miss the bigger points, and yeah, the insincere would be an understatement.
Yes, absolutely agree. Another thing I found interesting about this section is the part about the impending general artificial intelligence singularity. And this is from 2019.
Yeah, yeah. And this is also saying something about that. Like, as I've come to understand praxeology better and better, my fear for a general artificial intelligence, as if I ever had a fear for it, I don't believe I did, but like, that is not possible. Like, artificial intelligence can never be its own master. It can only be someone, a human being's slave, simply because of why we do stuff at all. Like, any action we take is born out of a felt uneasiness, and the action we take is our attempt at removing that felt uneasiness. This is purely out of Mises. An artificial intelligence could never do that. Because it doesn't feel anything. Like, it's just ones and zeros. So maybe that something like that could emerge from a simpler system in the future. But right now, there is nothing is pointing in that direction. They don't have agency. They are perpetually, just tools for human beings to use. So back to my favorite Terry Pratchett quote, real stupidity beats artificial intelligence every time. And Bitcoin represents real stupidity.
Well, even if artificial intelligence isn't actually intelligent, and it's real enough in the sense that it is, well, it comes out of things that are in the real world, because no matter what anyone thinks about this, digital realm, the internet, there are physical computers that do all of the things eventually. It's all computers all the way down. But the thing about it is, artificial intelligence could have profound effects on society, and that's becoming more and more clear every day these days. But back in 2019, none of this stuff really emerged yet. None of the current AI stuff was really on the radar yet. That's what I was getting at.
Not at the consumer level, anyway. We don't know what was going on behind closed doors, if you're going to be conspiratorial about the whole thing. But still, yeah, I do believe it will change the way we interact with one another, and it will change everything. Still, I love this quote from the Pirate Bay movie, TPBAFK, where they say that they prefer the term AFK, away from keyboard, to IRL, in real life, because the internet is real life. Like, everything, it's real. Like, the interactions you have on social media, they often get criticized. And the critics say that this is not real life, and we should go out in nature and go back to some Rousseauan nature boy philosophy thing. But the internet is absolutely real. All of it is real. The information is real. Whether it's lies or not, that's another question. But these are, as you say, they are computers working somewhere doing stuff. So treat it as what it is. Like, treat the internet as a real thing.
And Bitcoin as a real thing.
Absolutely. Like, yes, the most abstract thing you can imagine, maybe, but real nonetheless.
Great. I think let's continue. Unlike the termite, we humans are able to experience the grandeur of our progress. We can look in awe at the Sistine Chapel or the pyramids, and we can delve into the technicalities and brief history of Bitcoin and discover new ways of thinking about value along the way. Money is the language in which we express value to each other through space and time. Now that language is spoken by computers. Value expressed in this language can't be diluted through inflation or counterfeiting any longer. It is a language that is borderless, permissionless, peer-to-peer, anonymous, if you have the skills, unreplicable, completely scarce, non-dilutable, unchangeable, untouchable, undeniable, fungible, and free for everyone on Earth to use. It is a language for the future, and it emerged out of a specific set of events in the past. All languages are examples of complex systems emerging out of simpler things. And Bitcoin evolved just as organically as any other human language did. Knut?
Yes, the crucial point here is that this is a communications technology, and that Bitcoin has somewhat blatantly pointed out that money is nothing but, like, money is just communication. Communication with a cost, if you will. And you don't need gold in a vault or, you know, in God we trust printed on every bill and water stamps and whatnot. It's just information. Humans talk to one another, and, like, this is also why any laws around Bitcoin are so vulgar, because they, at least from a First Amendment perspective, like, if you're pro free speech, you cannot simultaneously be pro capital gains tax on Bitcoin, for instance, because this is just speech. That's what it is.
Yeah, and to extend this a little bit further, I'll actually reference, we've had some comments on this series since we've started putting it out, and one person on Noster didn't really get the point of the first chapter, Everything a Trade, that Everything a Trade kind of is dilutive somehow of the human experience. And I can see that argument. I can understand how maybe that seems like it's taking the nuance or the zest out of life if it's broken down into everything being a transaction. But first of all, that's missing the point, kind of. It's not that there can't be all of this other texture and flavor to life while still being that every interaction is fundamentally that both parties think that they are getting something good out of the interaction, or else it wouldn't happen at all, or it's non-consensual or non-voluntary. But I think the point that is missed also is that it's a really simple principle that is descriptive. That's all. It's not saying anything in terms of how the world should be, right? It's not like we should be looking at the world as if everything is a trade. Maybe it's useful to peek behind the curtain and start to look at the world in those terms. Maybe there's a risk that by looking behind the curtain, everything seems dull and boring. Maybe that's possible. But to take this to the speech analogy, which is why I brought that all up to connect this, speech being money, these two concepts being directly related to one another, is really just that the concept of money is this imaginary ledger, and I'm really using imaginary a specific way here. It's this thing that we've come up with to hold value in place in between cashing it in, basically, for stuff that we actually need. So it's the oldest abstraction, even if it is held in real things. Stores of value, mediums of exchange over time, media, if you're media of exchange over time, if you're a grammar Nazi. But yeah, the concept of speech being money, it's really that you are choosing to put your value into some store, right? And so just the same thing as if everything is being a trade, money and speech being the same thing is also just one of these descriptors. It's the way you've decided to abstract value. And we've talked about this on the Bitcoin Infinity show in the past, how really you could actually do all this stuff with just a spreadsheet or a ledger held between two people if you trust each other. The problem is that just doesn't scale. Going back to your point about how decentralization how decentralization is unfortunately necessary in order to prevent attacks and all this. We could just decide to carry a mental spreadsheet between every person in the world, but someone's going to cheat. And so the corollary on this also of all of these things is it's just descriptions of how the world is working. None of this is, it's Bitcoin is taking money down to its absolute basic form. The thing that is closest to pure speech. I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, and to address the guy on Noster's points further, I think this has to do with what the word trade is hijacked, or has been hijacked. Like, I think from a Keynesian perspective, there's a somewhat derogatory term to say that everything is a trade. Like, but the Austrian school is the only one that takes all. When the Austrian school talks about profit, it doesn't mean only monetary or financial profit, financial gains. It means everything that person feels is good for them. So even altruism or suicide is an act pursuing profit, because if you're suicidal, you want to take your own life because you think you will get into a state of better well-being, or you will at least not have the suffering of life all over you. Then, so that is profit-seeking behavior too. So everything a trade, it's not trying to diminish any other values you can have in life. It's just taking all the values into account. And I think that's a crucial point to make. It's not a cynic's view of the world at all, but the opposite. It takes all into account and just admits that whenever humans interact, we do exchange one thing for another. And that is trade. Like, that's the point.
Very good summary. Shall we move on?
Absolutely.
On to the next one. Decentralization is hard to achieve. Really hard. When it comes to claims of decentralization, a don't trust verify approach to the validity of such claims will help you filter out the noise. So, how can the validity of Bitcoin's decentralization be verified? It's a tricky question because decentralization is not a binary thing like life or death, but rather a very difficult concept to define. However, the most fundamental concepts in Bitcoin, like the 21 million cap on coin issuance, or the 10-minute block interval as a result of the difficulty adjustment and the proof-of-work algorithm, have not changed since very early on in the history of the network. This lack of change, which is arguably Bitcoin's biggest strength, has been achieved through the consensus rules, which define what the blockchain is. Some special mechanisms, for example, BIP9, are sometimes used to deploy changes to the consensus rules. These mechanisms use a threshold when counting blocks that signal for a certain upgrade. For example, the upgrade segregated witness, activated in a node when 95% or more of the blocks in a retarget period signaled support. Bitcoin has displayed a remarkable immutability through the years, and it is highly unlikely that this would have been the case if the game theoretical mechanisms that enable its decentralized governance model hadn't worked, given the many incentives to cheat that always seem to corrupt monetary systems. In other words, the longer the system seems to be working, the higher the likelihood that it actually does. Very good description of some of the ways Bitcoin works.
Yeah, but there are so many misconceptions about this. And I mean, even with a system as robust as this, there were some side effects of segregated witness that we couldn't foresee. Some of it has, there are good arguments for why the witness discount has helped shitcoins on Bitcoin, the spam issue, come to being, and that it could have been done a better way. Still, we sometimes the protocol just has to upgrade. For instance, segregate witness allowed for the Lightning Network, which allows Bitcoin to scale as a medium of exchange over space rather than time, and it's the only way for it to scale while keeping its decentralization, which is crucial for its security, which is crucial for the entire project. So it has to upgrade this way. And I sometimes get the question what I think about ossification. And the thing about ossification, which is like the point where Bitcoin doesn't change anymore, is that we can never know whether that has happened or not. Like, everything is still up for debate. Like, you still have node runners and people signaling stuff in the network, and that will always be true. So, like, from a certain perspective, Bitcoin cannot ossify, but it can be. What it can be is resistant to change, and that is a feature, not a bug. Whenever there's a change in the protocol, you somewhat change the economic incentives for the miners. And this is very, very crucial to not do. So all the changes will have to have as little an impact on miner behavior as possible in order for this to work as the sociological innovation sound money, like a super sound money. I don't want to say ultrasound, but super sound money, like money with a finite supply.
The ossification point is interesting, and the connection to the consensus rules also. I think your point about that there should be as little minor impact is only one part of the equation, though. It's all users of the protocol, really, with miners being one of them.
Of course. Every economic actor.
Right. And to that point, sometimes the effects of changes to the consensus rules are not even seen until years later down the road. Like, for example, SegWit and Taproot eventually enabled things that have turned into large exploits of the original rules or the intention of the rules that have resulted in quite a bit of spam coming onto Bitcoin, the Bitcoin blockchain. And, well, we're adamantly against that. And I think we would even go so far as to say that the spam on Bitcoin is just the same thing, worse even than the worst crypto scams, because it's actively making Bitcoin worse for everyone else. And it was through stuff that was unforeseen consequences, bugs or exploits, if you can call them that emerged out of previous rule changes. And now there's an argument that changing those rules retroactively would be unfair, because miners can theoretically make more if dummies with wizard hats decide to put frog JPEGs on Bitcoin. And so that's not a good situation either. We have to be very careful with this stuff.
Absolutely. And here, two things can be true at the same time, which is you can simultaneously think that the spam is crap and that people oughtn't do it, and also be against a hard fork or any violent change to the rules. I think that in the end, the best way to solve any issue like this, what do you call it, like a usability issue or whatever, is to educate people and to make them understand that this is not a, hate to use the term proper, but this is not proper profit-seeking behavior unless you're a scammer. So education is key here, I think.
All right, on to the next one. Satoshi set in stone the length of the halving period, a very important aspect of Bitcoin's issuance schedule and initial distribution. During the first 4 years of Bitcoin's existence, 50 new coins were issued every 10 minutes up until the first block reward halving 4 years later. Every 4 years, this reward is halved so that the issuance rate goes down by 50%. This effectively means that half of all the Bitcoin that will ever exist was mined during the first 4 years of the network's life, 1/4 during its next 4 years, and so on. At the time of writing, we're a little more than a year from the third halving. After that, only 6.25 Bitcoin will be minted every 10 minutes as opposed to 50, which was the initial rate. What this seems to do is create hype cycles for Bitcoin's adoption. Every time the price of Bitcoin booms and then busts down to a level above where it started, a hype cycle takes place. Bitcoin had no marketing whatsoever, so awareness of it had to be spread through some other mechanism. When a bull run begins, people start talking about it, which leads to even more people buying due to fear of missing out. FOMO, which inevitably causes the price to rise even more rapidly. This leads to more FOMO, and on the bull market goes until it suddenly ends, and the price crashes down to somewhere around or slightly above the level it was at before the bull run started. Unlike what is true for most other assets, Bitcoin never really crashes all the way. Why? Because every time a hype cycle occurs, some more people learn about Bitcoin's fundamentals and manage to resist the urge to sell, even when almost all hope seems lost. They understand that these bull markets are a reoccurring thing due to the nature of the protocol. These cycles create new waves of evangelists who start promoting Bitcoin simply because of what they stand to gain from a price increase. In a sense, the protocol itself pays for its own promotion in this way. This organic marketing creates a lot of noise and confusion too, as a lot of people who don't seem to understand how Bitcoin works are often very outspoken about it despite their lack of knowledge. Red herrings, such as altcoins and Bitcoin forks, are then weeded out naturally during bear markets. Every time a bull market happens, a new generation of Bitcoiners is born. Great. Again, describing some good educational description of what's going on here in the Bitcoin world.
Yeah, in hindsight, this is a very speculative paragraph. Like, I happily admit that I cannot know any of these things. If this was deliberate from Satoshi, if this is actually what triggered the bull market, and all of that is speculation. It certainly seems like Bitcoin evolves or Bitcoin adoption goes in these cycles, and that these cycles are somewhat coupled with the halvings. Also important to point out here that it's not the miners that find the Bitcoin. The miners find the blocks where the Bitcoin are in, and we allow the miners to give themselves those Bitcoins as payment for the work they provide for the rest of the network. So that's a crucial distinction here, which is not touched upon in this chapter, right? But I think that's good to point out. Also, this is to emphasize a point made earlier in the chapter. We are here to study Bitcoin, not be opinionated about it. And this is in the territory of studying the thing and like trying to make sense of it. It's also you know, if you use the towel before or after you shower, you get a different result. So if Bitcoin had, we cannot know how Bitcoin would have behaved and how the hype cycles would have, what the hype cycles would have looked like had it had a smooth diminishing returns, you know, issuance curve instead of these halvings every 4 years. We cannot know. All we know is that it works the way it was designed. Like we're in the timeline we're in, and it works here. So that tells us that at least it was good enough. And this is one of my favorite quotes. I think it's Tomer Strawlite. Bitcoin was never needed to be perfect, just good enough to last forever. And I love that quote.
Yeah, it's a great quote. And, you know, and then another thing here that we've talked about before is that it was an interesting coincidence that the halvings occur in U.S. presidential election years. So there's a really big shakeup every 4 years, depending on whether there's a change in presidencies.
Yeah, but also, like, I think people overestimate the U.S. presidential elections and what kind of impact they have. Of course, they have some kind of impact, but... but I mean, if there's a senile person or a buffoon in the White House, like Honey Badger does not care. Like the whole point of Bitcoin is to not have to worry about politics. One Bitcoin still equals one Bitcoin.
Devil's advocate on this. Macro still exists. The world economy still exists.
On fiat.
Yes. Well, but hey, I'm going to push back on this slightly, because the issue here is really that Bitcoin adoption occurs by two mechanisms: people getting into Bitcoin and money getting into Bitcoin. You can also really make the argument that it's always money getting into Bitcoin because people are going to bring a certain amount of money, and the money is the more impactful thing, really. And so if you have the traditional world economy is getting messed around with, and everyone is in a panic, is in an uproar, there's uncertainty. Of course, more and more people are going to get Bitcoin over time, and those people are going to some degree, put their wealth, their money into Bitcoin. Again, to some degree, if they really get Bitcoin all the way, it's going to be most, if not all, of their wealth. But anyway, but if the rest of the world economy is in turmoil, that's not necessarily going to happen quite as quickly, or at least it's going to be affected by the conditions around it. I've liked what Michael Saylor and others since him, I think, he's at least the first person that said something resembling this, that basically Bitcoin is only one half of the ledger. The rest of the economy, like where stuff is happening, that's the other half. Bitcoin is the measure of value in whatever sense that that means. But the world still is a place where things happen, and that's the other half. And so that place is where you can still have quite a lot of things that affect whether Bitcoin adoption is going to happen.
All right. I love this because now I'm going to devil's advocate your devil's advocate here. First of all, money does not measure value. It signals value, which is a crucial distinction and a Austrian economics insight. Also, I would say it could make the argument that only people come into Bitcoin and not money, because money, as we know it today, is not real. It's just a measurement of how fooled people have been into playing all the fiat games. So paper Bitcoin is not Bitcoin. All the ETFs in the world, and even MicroStrategy is Bitcoin, are held by a custodian, which means at the end of the day, it's some guy keeping a secret from some other guy. That's what unlocks the Bitcoin. And what we're the thing I'm looking forward to is not seeing nation states fight over Bitcoin. I'm looking forward to the final scene of Fight Club, where you have all the skyscraper just falling down and me standing there having blown half my face off with my girlfriend and just enjoying the show. Like, that is what happens when these institutions are going to learn, like everyone else, that Bitcoin custody is important and you shouldn't leave it to other people. Sooner or later, that doesn't work. You have to take control yourself. And this it completely redraws the map of what finance is and what money is, what information is, what being a human being is. So at its very core, it's a much deeper revolution than any of these fiat institutions that exist now can even fathom. I prefer to look at this in 400 years into the future than 4 years. What impact does this have on our children's 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 grandchildren? Not what impact does it have during the next election?
Sure. Good points here. I think we're both right to some extent. The economy does exist and things do happen. But as you say, the trajectory, and those of us who have grokked what this thing is believe that the trajectory is inevitable, but there could still be bumps along the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think both statements can be true at the same time. It's just a question of how much you zoom out. If you zoom in, this what's going on with Bitcoin and macro is super interesting and important to get people to get this thing right now. But from a helicopter perspective, it's just a blip on the radar.
Well, and to tie it back to the other point from this paragraph here and the chapter as a whole, it's all bottom up anyway, which is to say that basically the stuff going on external to Bitcoin, you're right that Bitcoin doesn't care, but it also does mean the flip side is that it means that Bitcoin's own internal marketing and the hype cycles as they exist really do have some dependence on what's going on outside of it. People may come and go from being strong advocates for Bitcoin, especially if Bitcoin rises enough that their stacks are big enough that you can just ride off into the sunset. Some percentage of people, I'm sure, have just done that, right?
Yeah. And to add to that, I mean, even the fiat economy and the legacy finance system or monetary system is also bottom up. It is what it is because people have allowed it to materialize, because people haven't been vigilant enough to double check that their money isn't being counterfeited. That's why macro is a thing at all. So you could claim that everything is bottom up. Bitcoin is just the people finally figuring out what is going on and actively resisting it. That's what it is. And I do not believe that there's any future where Bitcoin and the US dollar can coexist, not in the long run. Bitcoin is the antidote to the disease that is the US dollar.
Well, on that note, I think we should just read the final paragraph, which we seem to have gotten to the core idea of. And I'll also just quickly make a note, sort of, that this is one of those chapters that in your earlier books is a bit of a fall off the cliff, you know? But that's okay. We've summarized the whole thing in our discussion. So I'll go read the thing. The four-year period between halvings seems to serve a deliberate purpose. Satoshi could just as well have programmed a smooth issuance curve into the Bitcoin protocol, but he didn't. As events unfold, it seems that he had good reason for this, since these hype cycles provide a very effective onboarding mechanism, and they seem to be linked to the halvings. They certainly make Bitcoin volatile. But remember that in this early stage, the volatility is needed in order for these hype cycles to happen. Later on, when Bitcoin's stock-to-flow ratio is higher, the seas will calm, and its volatility level will go down. In truth, it already has. The latest almost 80% price drop was far from the worst we've seen in Bitcoin. This technology is still in its infancy, and it is very likely that we'll see a lot more volatility before mainstream adoption or hyper-Bitcoinization truly happens. So.
Yeah, again, very speculative, and maybe not something I would have put in a book today. There's a lot of speculation here. But there is... Volatility going down is an observable thing. Like Bitcoin is not as volatile as it used to be. Like when it was in the just a handful of dollars range, it was way more volatile back then. So just like waves, waves on a bigger and bigger ocean are more insignificant to the movement of the ocean. Like Bitcoin's volatility also goes down as more and more wealth gets funneled into it.
Yeah, and I think this is pretty much exactly what we've been talking about here already. The volatility and the amount of wealth that is coming into Bitcoin is getting more and more significant, and it seems to be taking more wealth to kind of move the needle upwards. But a thing that also ignores is that more and more people are hodling. There's more and more Bitcoin off the exchanges and in cold storage. And at some point, it's not necessarily about the amount of wealth going into Bitcoin anymore. It's just the amount of people that are willing to sell is drying up, getting smaller and smaller. And those groups of people will continue to get smaller and smaller also. So...
Yeah, I mean, a way I like to visualize this is a literal stairway to heaven. And the stairway is 50 meters wide the first 4 years up into the sky, and then 25, and then 12.5. And you have a lot of people in the beginning, there's not a lot of people trying to get up the stairs. But as more and more people start to flock to these 50 meters width of stairway or 50 bitcoins, all of a sudden the stairway gets crammed, and you have every once in a while you have an outlier trying to reach heaven faster, and he runs up the stairs and that becomes the price, and he looks down and holy shit, it's high up here, and he runs down again, but there's a flock of people right preventing him from going all the way down the stairs, and that's the hodlers of last resort, and they're more and more every year. So like, if you really want to get a more objective view of what's going on in Bitcoin and in terms of price and purchasing power, look at the yearly lows and not the all-time highs. If you look at the yearly lows, you could you get a much clearer picture of what is going on.
And with that, I think that's a good summation of the chapter. The organics of this, the bottom-up approach, everything emerging organically, and that what Bitcoin has done can never be replicated, something like that. Do you have any other words in summation?
No, I thought that was a great summary.
You did too.
Yeah, simpler, complex things emerging out of simpler things. It's all natural. It's what free markets are supposed to do, like it did with the mobile phone and so on. So, looking forward to discussing the next chapter. What's the next chapter about?
Great stuff. Yeah, the next one is proof of work.
Oh, that's going to be interesting.
That'll be a fun one. We've definitely had some new thoughts about proof of work. So this episode will be out, is free on Nostr. So go check out the text. We'll have a link in the description to the text of the chapter, so you can read it and leave a comment with what you thought about this episode. If you have any thoughts, if you have something you disagree with, let us know. Like we did in this episode, we might go back and talk about that at a future date. So please do that. And if you want to get involved with the discussion, you can join the Bitcoin Infinity Academy yourself. We have our private Telegram group where you can ask us questions and you can hear about everything going on in the Bitcoin Infinity world. So all the information is at geyser.fund/project/infinity, or you can just check out the Bitcoin Infinity store for all of our books, everything else we're doing. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and brush your teeth.
Yeah, and go and check out planb.network for Bitcoin education. They've just started their early summer course here, and they have some great educational tools. I highly recommend you take their course on Bitcoin, either the business side or the technology side. They have something for everyone.
Absolutely agree. Can't say enough good things about Plan B, and it's great synergy that we're working with them on this project, this initiative to discuss all of the chapters of all of your books. Knut, is a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it, and I hope it brings a lot to a lot of different people. So really hope to see you in the next one and that you enjoy this series. And also we have to thank Bitbox, our favorite hardware wallet manufacturer, and they being great partners of us, of our Bitcoin Infinity show and now the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Go to bitbox.swiss/infinity for more information about the Bitbox 02 hardware wallet. They're absolutely top notch on security and easy to use. So we recommend Bitbox, and yeah, go check it out.
Yeah, go Switzerland.
Go Switzerland, absolutely. Any last words, Knut? Anything else to add?
That would be the word spadoinkle, as you know, like always.
Yeah, that was predictable. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. I think we'll call it a day then, hey?
Yes. See you on the next one, Luke.
See you, Knut. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thank you for listening.